Welcome to the Nonprofit Hub Radio Podcast, where we highlight nonprofit innovators, leaders, and influencers every week that are changing the sector for the better. I'm your host, Delaney Mullenix, Executive Director of Nonprofit Hub. If you're not for profit and all for purpose, you're in the right place. You see, we know you're already doing good, but we've designed this podcast to help nonprofit professionals find growth, joy, and connection. So tune in weekly for new episodes to elevate your cause, spread the news, and share the resources we share with you. Build momentum and be unstoppable at the 2023 CauseCamp Nonprofit Conference. CauseCamp is named one of the top nonprofit conferences of the year. Everyone who attends the conference is there to work with you to solve real issues facing your organization, from trivial to complex. Level up your professional knowledge and the strategies of your organization with insights from the top minds in the sector. Get to know nonprofit peers nationwide at pre- and post-show events, and visit over 35 resource and solution providers in Camper Village. Join us on September 14th and 15th on America's Rock and Roller Coast in Huron, Ohio. For more than 150 years, people have chosen the Lake Erie region as their destination to connect with each other and create new memories. Grab your ticket at www.cause.camp and reignite your purpose at CauseCamp 2023.
We'd like to thank Lasso Digital for sponsoring today's episode of the Nonprofit Hub Radio Podcast. Lasso Digital is your full-service partner in communications and fundraising, helping your nonprofit to raise more funds, share your vision, and achieve your mission. Learn more at lassodigital.co. That's lassodigital.co.
Delaney Mullenix here with Nonprofit Hub. I had the pleasure of speaking with Eric Leslie. He is the founder of Union Capital Boston, which is a nonprofit organization that transforms social capital into opportunity by rewarding community engagement. And they have combined technology and relationship building to spark social capital, whether that's parents attending school events, engaging in voting, and all sorts of civic and social engagement to improve the community. And they've seen extreme improvements on the community that they're working in and are hoping to take this model into other cities as well. Some of the impacts that they've seen are very significant decreases in unemployment and so much more. Stay tuned to hear more about the good work that Eric is doing. Welcome, Eric. It's so nice to have you.
I'm really pleased to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, of course. Well, one thing that I wanted to start with is, can you share a little bit about Union Capital Boston? And then I want to really dive into your passion behind the work and how you got started and what you're doing now.
Yeah, delighted to share. As I'm, the founder of the organization, so there is a bit of that. It's a work of passion and persistence in building what we've done for the 9 years since we founded the organization. And our name, hopefully, gives people pause and confusion. Union Capital, right? It sounds like a bank or a railroad company or something like that. But it is, as the topic of this conversation is about social capital. This very academic, wonky term, as it turns out, is very powerful and important and transformative in building opportunity for everybody. But I think importantly in our mission and my commitment and my upbringing and values, the work towards equity in our country and working to address systems of institutionalized racism and oppressive structures, we often importantly invest in pathways of education, right? And human capital. We try to build financial capital and pathways of opportunity to build our finances. But we find a lot of those efforts come up short. And it's not because they're bad or not needed, but I think there's a gap and a connection in building social capital, the relationships and resources that open up doorways of opportunity, both for individuals and collectively as a community. We know the cliches to be true, that it's not what you know but it's who you know. And as much as we might want to say that knowledge is power, we see a lot of powerful people with not necessarily a whole lot of knowledge. Yeah. There's other pathways to There's other pathways to opportunity. So I'm happy to share more about kind of my lived experience and bringing that to life.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah, tell me about your experience. I know that from a long time ago, you've had this passion for community organizing. I mean, where did you get started?
I was born and raised in Cambridge, Massachusetts with hippie parents. Cambridge is a unique place to grow up in, good and bad. It is a place that many people see as having this bubble of this progressive values and elitism. And it cuts both ways, I think. There is this great commitment to justice and equity and opportunity, but it does not, as a city, always live up to it. And my lived experience was being exposed to an understanding that what I was being afforded, the benefits that I had being born white, male, and having access to education and doors open for me, was not the case for my friends and neighbors, depending on their background and lived experience. And that Cambridge, like everywhere, is a place of immense hypocrisy, and that who you are and where you're born, what you have access to, is going to determine your pathway and opportunities. And organizing for me, first in high school as a youth organizer, and then working and learning from incredible heroes of the veterans of the civil rights struggle in Mississippi, and with organizers in Baltimore, New York City, organizing spoke to me because it's about being in relationship with people, with community. And rather than feeling like I or any one person or a researcher or a policy analyst has the answer or the solution to any systemic inequity, it's about listening, learning, and understanding what people's lived experiences are, where their frustrations are exist, and what they want to see happen. Because most often it's not these radical changes. It's very common sense things of building better schools and access, affordable housing and job opportunities, these bedrocks and foundations of communities for centuries that we need today. And organizing is a pathway to do that, because it is about people then putting in the work, knocking on the doors, getting out the votes, petitioning for change where they live, and not people flying in and flying out and saying, we know what's best for you. And that spoke to me, again, as someone who has benefited from so much of the privilege of this country, to not then think I know and have the solutions for others, but to work in relationship and alongside others to make a positive impact.
Yeah, of course. Unfortunately, there are individuals who also grew up in similar circumstances to you in a privileged environment, but still don't admit that. That they have these privileges. So
I want to just touch on for a moment, it means a lot to me to know and to share, my father passed away in February, and he was someone who passed on to me through his lived experience just a commitment to doing good work. And when we shared his life story at celebrations, what really emerged in knowing more, and as I learned more about his life, especially his younger years, was he was someone who had come to Cambridge and worked in nonprofit careers as an educator and with civic organizations and the university system. And the theme in his work was doing good work for good people. And that touched me. I didn't know it maybe as a child, but your parents influence you. And that stayed with me. And as I look back on his life and how he inspired me, it's there throughout, of just wanting to be with good people, doing good work. We don't always, make the world change in a day. But to share a good meal and a laugh, and to feel like you're working alongside other people, counts for something good.
Yeah, of course. Well, he sounds like an excellent role model, and I'm sorry to hear that he's passed.
Thank you. Thank you.
So your title, although you're the founder of Union Capital Boston, your title is lead organizer. And I want to know a little bit more about what exactly that means. And I know one of the questions I wanted to ask, I feel like my family, if I try to describe to them what I do, running a digital media platform and being like a connected ecosystem of nonprofit resources, they just like don't understand. They're like, we have no idea what you do. You've told us like a billion times that you just don't understand it. Yeah. I feel like maybe lead organizer can be that way. I mean, how would maybe your parents describe what you do compared to what you actually do?
It's funny. It's a great question. That as a early career in organizing, community organizing, before 2008, before Barack Obama and people understood like, oh, here was someone who was a community organizer. Oftentimes I would tell friends and family that I was an organizer and like get a blank look and have to be like, no, not like closets.
Like a project or like a project manager.
Yeah. That's right. Not like home organization or, you know, right? Like not home organizing projects, community. But I think with President Obama and kind of his story and understanding, like, oh yeah, you organize in the South Side of Chicago. What does that mean? There's a little bit better of an understanding. Now what we're doing at Union Capital is also not traditional community organizing. Mm-hmm. We are building this network of social capital. We are not rallying at the state house and doing petitions. So then there is that additional step that is, you know, I think for a lot of friends and family, you know, the general understanding is that I'm working in relationship with communities to access more resources and build pathways of opportunity, both for families and the community as a whole. And the reason the term lead organizer, you know, at certain times or on legal paperwork, I'm also the executive director, right? You've got to sign the forms that way. But it's an important semantic thing that we decided to have this term lead organizer, because our work is about having people get organized in community spaces, in their schools, neighborhood organizations and programs. And as the lead, I kind of have my hand in everything. As we talk about nonprofit work, yes, I'm doing, you know, fundraising and outreach, but I'm a little bit of program, a little bit of operations, a little bit of management. It's I think more descriptive than saying I'm executive directing and I'm just kind of sitting in this chair pointing what to do. As an organizer, you're in the mix and in relationship with people every day.
Yeah. Well, that's well put. Okay, so if you could just briefly, just for everyone listening, briefly describe again what social capital is.
That's right. So social capital is the access to resources and relationships that we all have that open up doorways of opportunities. And we can think about it maybe concretely in terms of employment. You know, upwards of 80% of all jobs in the United States are obtained through personal relationships. Mm. That is, again, not what you know, but who you know. And we can all take a moment to pause and think, what was that internship I had, or that one, maybe not every job, but that one job where a friend, family member put in a good word or they worked there? That's social capital. But it's not just there, right? It's why do we go see the movies that we see or choose the gym that we do, buy the home where we are? It isn't just because we read a good book about it. It isn't because we went to a class. It's the social capital that we have that says, hey, I have a friend who's a realtor, right? Or, oh, you're a neighbor, you need some eggs and a cup of sugar. That is what social capital is on a daily basis. And I think the pandemic brought about a heightened awareness of what mutual aid as another form of social capital is. How are we checking on our neighbors in need? Or how are we offering support to those that are struggling? Another way to measure the question in financial terms, there's often a national survey of if in need or have an emergency, who can you go to? How many people can you go to for $500? And it's very stark. That's upward of 40% of Americans. The answer is no one, right? That in an emergency, you do not have access to $500. But it's not a question of do you have $500? That's a financial capital question. But social capital is, where can you go, right? Family, friend, church, faith organization, civic organization, to be like, hey, my car is in, you know, I'm going to lose my job. My car is in the shop. I need $500. That is another way to think about the importance and the value of building social capital. This was really brought to, I wouldn't say like the forefront of mainstream understanding, but certainly in academic circles. Robert Putnam wrote a seminal book called Bowling Alone, published in about 2000, which is when I was starting my career. And it really stayed with me in his research about social capital, measuring the decline of it in American society.
I was just going to ask that. I remember learning this in my master's program. A lot of my professors talked about how things like Rotary clubs, any type of like community organization that you kind of like voluntarily associate with, were like on like huge declines. And I think about like my generation, my circle, I don't think is highly involved in things like that anymore, which is, I think,
all the trend continues, right? I don't, you know, his research was now 20 years ago, but I think updated from it. And the reason that the bowling alone title is so important is what he found, at least at that time, is it wasn't that people were bowling less. You could say, oh, well, maybe just bowling isn't popular anymore. It's that they weren't bowling in groups and teams. But the rate of bowling remained the same. It's just as popular as it was in the 1950s or 60s, but people were not doing it as together. What he then went on to research, and I think what we can now feel and experience, especially in this past decade, the more that we are disconnected from each other and from community, the more that we get hunkered down, you know, in our computers, on social media, in these closed feedback loops, the more we get disconnected from a collective spirit of what it, you know, means to be an American, what it means to support each other, what it means to work towards justice, what it means to help and be helped. And we still maybe have very small, narrow lines of that, and we have tighter circles that are important. But with the changes in communities, with gentrification, with the decline in religious affiliation, with the decline in labor unions, with more school choice and opportunity, you don't have communities as frequently where you have families that maybe multi-generational grew up in the same home, worship the same place, work the same labor union job, children are at the same schools years after year. You don't have these natural spaces to meet and connect. Yeah. And so that became our mission. How do we do that? If neighbors are constantly moving, if you're in a big city that's bustling and you have the gig economy and you have, you know, all these, you know, disconnects, languages and faiths, and yet the act of being in relationship is so powerful and transformative, how can we do that? Because you can't just force neighbors to know each other and like each other.
Mm-hmm. And I know that I love to talk a little bit more about your program and how you are building the social capital, because a couple of things I'm curious about. You're using a reward system. So I'm curious about that. And then I also noticed you guys talk about bridging technology and relationship building.
Yeah. Thanks for asking. So that's where we started and have continued every day, every year, learn and grow in creating kind of a disruptive idea, which was the starting point for Union Capital, was a rewards program. And our mission is to transform social capital into opportunity by rewarding community engagement, which is quite a mouthful. This is what happens when I have a master's
degree. You say it well, like, right? You must have to say
it. I'm a little rehearsed in it, but even those words could have a dissertation behind it. But the disruptive starting point was to say, look, if we have this research and knowledge that community engagement, being in civic clubs or any other community space, is valuable, what if we were then to value it? Just like a shopper's rewards card, getting points for, you know, going shopping, or frequent flyers, or, you know, a coffee app, they want you to come do business there. We're going to reward you for the hours that you take to volunteer, to attend community meetings, to help a neighbor, to go to a block party, anything in which you are engaged in community. And these days that also includes Zoom, right? If you're digitally engaged in community as well, you earn 100 points an hour in our app program. Okay. And those points add up to a little bit of money. Our members who are economically struggling identified, look, as the research shows about cash transfers, I know what to do with my money. I just need a little bit more of it. So it comes in the form of a Visa gift card. And it doesn't build your credit. You can't invest it. It's a little bit of money that's not taxed. It's a gift. And you can earn up to $500 a year. It's not, we don't have to report it. We don't need social security numbers, but it's not a lot of money. On average, our members who are engaged and are participating earn about $200 a year on Visa gift cards. It's not going to pay the rent. It's not about replacing a job, but $200 that you can put towards holiday gifts or a bill that's been adding up. And encourage you to step into that space that maybe you wanted to be in. You weren't sure you had the time to be in. You had to take a shift off of work to, you know, to be at your child's back to school night. And here's a little bit of money as a thank you and a recognition and encouragement. But the key part to your question that I think we understood from the beginning, I'm not a tech savvy guy. I'm kind of right at the cusp of the age of generation where I was like, I'm trying to keep up with understanding all these tech features and advancements. So our nonprofit is not like a tech venture, but it's built around technology. We have this digital platform. We knew that we needed to build relationships, and that's where the organizing comes in. If we're going to build trust, it can't just be on a digital device. We can't just put up a billboard and say, download this app and use it, because there's not going to be trust and understanding. What is this thing? You're meaning I'm going to log in. I'm going to tell you, you know, I was at my child's school for 2 hours. That's, I don't get that. That's, is this a scam? Is this a pyramid scheme? You're going to send me money? Like, this sounds like I'm being ripped off. Where's the catch? And that takes a relationship and a conversation through the leaders that we stipend and train to do outreach in the schools and the community centers and programs that we partner with to say, hey, I'm a member. Here's why we do this. We're a nonprofit. This isn't, you know, a get rich quick plan. This is about building opportunities and resources for us. And I'm inviting you to join me. Do you have questions about it? Here's how it works. Nothing else like this exists anywhere else, for better or for worse. Yeah. We're figuring this out. Give us your feedback. And so relationship building, that organizing approach, one by one, has been core to what we've been doing since the very beginning.
That's incredible. So how did you come up with the idea if it's never been done anywhere else?
Well, it's one of those interesting things, right? Where there was a relative light bulb moment or lightning bolt moment or whatever, but the lightning bolt had to come up through years of like built up kinetic energy, right? So I think reading Bowling Alone when I was 20 years old and organizing in Baltimore, and you know, in Sandtown, Winchester, West Baltimore, a beautiful, challenged, struggling community, where there were people living there, but not going to the institutions where we were organizing. They weren't in church. They weren't in the schools. Where were they? I didn't know, but I think the seeds were planted then. And then as a middle school principal, how do we get our parents into school? And the success of our children is very much going to be based not only on the algebra they learn in the class, but the access to resources and mentorship and programs outside of our school.
Yeah.
These challenges were swirling about. I think like most things in life, it takes that long walk, that breath of fresh air. And for me, it was a sabbatical living in New Zealand. I stepped away from being principal. I retired at an early age from that career of path. And my wife and I went and lived and worked in New Zealand for a year. And it's a small country with a very developed economy. It's about the size of the United Kingdom, landmass wise, whereas the United Kingdom has 60 million people. New Zealand has less than 5 million people.
Wow.
As a result, you only have two businesses of each product in town, but you have two gas stations, two airlines, two supermarkets. And to create a competitive advantage, we living there found out that kind of one of each of these companies had formed a rewards program. Mm-hmm. So essentially like the mobile gas, along with what was, you know, Air New Zealand and one of the supermarkets had come together. They were all separate businesses, but they had created one rewards program.
Oh, nice.
And we were like, all right, this is cool. Let's enroll in this. Now we're earning points, going to that gas station, going to that pharmacy, going to that supermarket, and it's adding up and we can cash it in for flight miles or golf clubs or whatever it might be. Simple stuff, but unique in that nothing like that exists in the United States because there's 500 supermarkets, there's 500 pharmacy chains. They don't all band together.
No.
And then the lightning bolt came of just saying, well, incentives seem to have this influencer effect. It's not the sole thing, but it's valuable. And there's also an efficiency of getting, rather than one company or one organization having to provide rewards. What if we did it collectively? And what if we did it instead of having you go shop somewhere, to do it, to have you volunteer, to participate, to engage. And so I was on the other side of the world and sat down and started to write up these ideas. And that's where it kind of snowballed from there.
Hi, this is Kevin Burgess, the editor of the Nonprofit Hub Radio podcast. We'd like to thank Lasso Digital for making today's episode possible. Your nonprofit is changing lives, and you deserve top-tier support to tell the world about it. That's why Lasso Digital offers a wide variety of marketing and fundraising services, from year-end appeals and capital campaigns to advertising and social media management. No matter what your needs, they can help you find the best strategies to accomplish your nonprofit's goals. Lasso Digital is here to be your partner in expanding your impact and reaching the people who matter most. Raise more funds, share your vision, achieve your mission. Learn more at lassodigital.co. That's lassodigital.co.
Okay, so I'm hearing that members who engage through the app in different types of community events, getting involved civically or otherwise, do they pay for the app to start using it? Because I know that you guys do like member events and network nights. Is that, I guess, how are you creating revenue through this model using the app and paying people for their involvement?
So I went to grad school and pulled up a spreadsheet and tried to learn some accounting and was pretty bad at it and was like, how is the budget gonna we're gonna get away from it? The thought was, or would we be a for-profit? It was very clear that this wasn't gonna be a profitable entity. So importantly, as a nonprofit, about 50% of our annual revenues come from direct philanthropy, from grants and foundational support. Predominantly the Boston area is a local organization. But importantly, what has evolved and made us sustainable and able to grow, so about 25% of our revenues come from the organizations that we partner with and the value add that we're bringing to them. Okay. So Boston Public Schools and charter schools, early childcare organizations, post-secondary programs, affordable housing developments, and community health centers all have members, whether it's parents and students, patients and residents, program participants, and they have a narrow mission, whether it's children's education or resident home ownership or patient health. But what these organizations recognize, as I've experienced recognized, is that the outcomes of their members are interconnected between housing and education and healthcare and on and on. And they can't deliver on all those things, nor should they. They've got to provide patient health or great student education. The value add that we're bringing to them, the proposition is to say, your members can get access and benefit from a wider array of resources and opportunities than you and your school can provide because you've got teachers that got to teach class, or your health center, you've got doctors that got to provide healthcare. We're not going to be a panacea and fix all the problems of your members, but they are going to get a little bit of money and they're going to access programs and opportunities. And what this has resulted in outcomes, and the reason why we're able to generate that revenue, is when members join our organization, about 23% report being unemployed. Mind you, this is in a city with unemployment now at about like 3.5%. Boston is doing pretty well as a whole, but just like anywhere, there are invisible groups and parts of the city that are forgotten and are struggling. 23% of our members, when they join, are unemployed. We match up that data every year in an annual survey with their entry survey. So that same cohort of members, apples to apples, in December of 2022, only 12% were unemployed.
That's insane.
It's pretty wild.
That's a good number.
Results.
Yes.
And honestly, like, I didn't believe it at first. And thankfully now it's been multiple years of getting this, along with other results in credit score improvement, education advancement, voter participation, that our members are getting, not because we're doing job training and placement. Goes back to, it's not what you know, it's who you know. If 80% of jobs are obtained through personal relationships and you can mathematically get more relationships, your percentage chance of getting a job is going to increase, along with the job trainings we're sharing about the career pathway programs that we're posting and sharing at our network nights and our community gatherings. And so these organizations are seeing the value add in that. And they're paying us a little bit, not a ton, right? It doesn't cover our costs, but $5,000 to $10,000 a year, depending on the size and scope. We're hiring a leader of theirs, a parent, a resident, a program participant. We're paying them. We're stipending them to be the ambassador and to do the outreach at their child's school, to be that trustworthy face, to share about this resource, and to put money back into their pocket. We often find a school that pays us $5,000 by the second year is getting a return on investment of upwards of $10,000. Wow. Because of the rewards that the members are earning, the stipend that the leader is getting. And then there's the benefit of saying, you've got a school, would you rather your parents be 23% unemployed or 12% unemployed?
Yeah.
It's going to be a value add created through this community engagement for that institution. And that's how we're able to balance the books bit by bit.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. I am super curious about what other impacts you've been having on the community, unemployment decrease being just one. What are some other things that you've seen happen?
So this was new to me, having been a principal and immersed in organizing work, about like, how do you measure value and quantify this? It's hard. I think that's the nonprofit world. We all struggle with, like, we do want to prove, right? We want to prove our impact is good. And some of it is just, it feels good. It looks good. We know it's good, but we understand that there is accountability, and figure out those measures is such a great learning process. What we are fortunate to build off of is a lot of mental research, because we, you know, can't do it ourselves. And a real seminal study from now, it's about 15 years ago now, but found that controlling for all other factors, communities that have higher rates of volunteerism, public meeting attendance, and helping of neighbors, irrespective of socioeconomic status, have higher rates of employment and voter participation. Lo and behold, those are some of the things we're measuring. Mm-hmm. We also then are measuring 45% of our members, when they join, don't know their credit score. Majority have scores of 600 or below. Again, in December of 2022, it had dropped to 32%, don't know their credit score, and dramatic increases, 600 and 700 and above, which is where credit can really start to mean and be mean something and be helpful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the November 2022 election, which in Massachusetts wasn't a competitive races going on, so turnout was pretty low across the board. Our members who are eligible to vote, over 70% turned out to vote in communities where turnout is typically 25 to 30%. So that interconnectedness of jobs, education gains, financial empowerment also brings out more civic participation. Voting is one representative proxy of that, but increased rates of volunteerism and meeting attendance means that politicians are more responsive, right? We go back to 2020, we participated in the census count work in Boston. We were able to track and increase census counting, which brings more federal dollars in, representation. All of these things being interconnected, we're finding come back to that act of building social capital.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see you going from here?
We're having a lot of great conversations with our board, a tremendous advisory council and partners and leaders, as we're in the midst of a 3-year strategic plan, which was to invest in leadership development. What we found is not only do the rewards help and our gathering spaces such as network nights get people out and attending things, but people want to make things happen. They want to lead and change. And they need a little bit of technical support and training. How do you create a business plan? How do you, develop a public narrative and a call to action? So we've developed a leadership training pipeline. Not that all, 4,000 of our members will participate in that, but that, we have a dozen or so this year going through this leadership training. What they grow and develop, mutual aid programs, advocacy groups, ripple back and benefit our members, because it's the communities where we live.
Yeah.
The second part where we see it going is literally and physically to another city. We're tremendously, grateful, excited, and curious to have been invited by organizations and funders in Springfield, Massachusetts, to launch Union Capital Springfield. So the headline here, and the kind of the, it's not even public, but coming in September of 2023. Is Union Capital Springfield.
Wow.
We have a director on the ground there. We have the technology that we're building, and we have the people and leaders starting to do the work. And it's going to be tremendous, because Springfield is a completely different city than Boston. It's mm-hmm. It's different size, population, interests, and needs. Does this work there? What doesn't work? What works better? What can we learn? And so I think we're excited about that cross-pollination, bringing best practices back and forth. I think it will strengthen what we do in Boston as we continue to grow, and we will bring what we've learned in Boston and not have to recreate the wheel in Springfield. And certainly we're not going to get ahead of ourselves. We're not eager to just grow for the sake of growth. But once we've done it somewhere else, we can see about the potential of, you know, is there a third community? Is there another place? Or are there other teachings and best practices that we can share elsewhere?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that you guys had listed this strategic plan that, again, you mentioned that you're in year three. You mentioned that you had an advisory board. You talk with your board a lot about developing that strategy for the future. How have you guys, I mean, how has that gone in the past 3 years? Like, do you feel like you've consistently made traction? Have you kind of had to go backwards and maybe like rethink some things in the strategic plan? Or do you feel that it's gone pretty smoothly since inception? Because we talk about strategic planning all the time with our nonprofits. Right. It's a huge topic of conversation. So any insight, recommendations, tips, anything?
So absolutely. And I will, I mean, the caveat, of course, is I'm lucky and fortunate that we didn't do our strategic plan, you know, in 2019. And then,
right.
We were doing our strategic planning. And first of all is pro bono consulting, right? Where you can get it, especially in this virtual world, like there's whether it's Bridgespan nationally does it a lot, then we've been able to work with them. Here in Boston, there was a pro bono group called Community Consulting Team, CCT. And I believe they have other chapters in other cities. We got a project assignment with them in the winter of 2021.
Okay,
cool. So we were kind of a full year into the pandemic and had gotten grounded of how we're doing virtual programming and we have our digital resources that we're sharing. So we had firmly grounded and pivoted to that reality. And thankfully, then we could dive into, okay, what do the next 3 years look like? I'm glad we didn't do that in 2019. Right. On the whole, things have progressed as we've set it out. But the takeaway from that is listen to the feedback, right? Like I came into it in my own head, you know, okay, strategic plan just means kind of grow, you know, more people, more program, more staff, right? I honestly wasn't necessarily that excited or inspired by it. Like,
Right. Okay,
that's the feedback, the team, you know, the volunteers conducted over 50 interviews of our stakeholders, our members, leaders, staff, board, advisors, funders, partner organizations. I didn't have the time to do that.
Right.
It was immense in them doing that because that's when they came back and said, we've heard a lot of things. But one of the things that really stood out was you have a lot of tremendous leaders and they don't know, they need more training and development. Mm-hmm. And if they're trained and developed, they could do a lot more for your members. And it was like another light bulb that turned on of like, it's been sitting in front of us all along. We have these great people who are hosting table talks at our network nights, who are doing food giveaways throughout the pandemic and, you know, PPE, you know, deliveries, all these tremendous things for their neighbors. And they want to lead more. Well, yeah, we absolutely should invest and train them more. We didn't then say we're going to conquer the world in the next 3 years. I think that's the important thing with strategic planning. We said, okay, we're going to hire a director of leadership. We're going to charge that director of leadership with creating leadership programming. We don't know what that entirely is going to look like, but we imagine there being some form of cohorts. And as those cohorts evolve, that there'll be alumni and then, you know, trainers training, you know, train the trainers, you know, and all those pieces have gradually taken place. Because we didn't get too specific, it gave us the flexibility in there that like, oh, we're going to develop this whole facilitation program that we didn't envision happening. We're going to create an investment fund in partnership with the Boston Foundation to award money to leaders, things that we didn't have in there. But it's not like we're off track. It's just, I think we gave ourselves enough leeway and flexibility. And it's running through 2024. So, you know, as we get into the next year, which will be our 10th year as an organization, we're going to have the opportunity to step back again and see what other, you know, things that are sitting right in front of us that I've been blinded to that will chart our next course.
Yeah, I think that's important too. Like you say, don't grow for growth's sake. We used to have, you know, our whole mission and vision has changed to become setting up nonprofits to achieve excellence. And there's like five pillars of business excellence. Like, how can we look at that through a nonprofit lens? And that doesn't just mean you're growing, not in any way, shape or form, but how are you creating value for the communities that you're serving?
And growth will come out of that.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you're providing the value, in our case, right, more people will want to join. Mm-hmm. Right. But it isn't like, oh, we've got to get more people to join because what if we're providing a bad product? Yeah. I think that puts it in the lead.
Yeah. There's also a lot of stress. I think that some nonprofit leaders feel stressed if growth isn't happening fast, like as quickly as like maybe they anticipated. And I just feel like that can be such a deterrent to actually doing like really good work. I'm a very patient person. I'd rather move very slowly, which maybe is like both a pro and a con.
I think it's a pro. Look, I mean, I think I was the ripe old age of like, you know, 33 or so as I was starting this. So I think I was, you know, a little bit older than maybe, you know, coming right out of college. And I remember early on having this kind of pull in me because I was having to pitch this, right? And I'm going to nonprofit pitch competitions and putting my slides up. And of course, there's here's the slide about growth. And I could tell that my heart wasn't fully in it because you kind of had this exponential growth curve, right? And, you know, by 5 years, we're going to be in 15 cities. Like, I didn't want to be. I didn't think we would be, but I also had this pull of like, well, the judges want to know that we've got this viability that can expand.
Right.
And it didn't, like, we didn't win those competitions, nor should we, right? And I think ultimately, like, it felt really good to be grounded in a place of like linear growth is something that I feel wonderfully comfortable with, right? That, you know, you find the program that you need, the staff that you have to do it, the funding to support it, and you kind of build it as a brick and things, you know, diagonally step forward from there. But it's not about like, how do we 10x everything?
Yeah.
You're going to lose quality. You're going to lose sleep. And you're not going to achieve your mission, I think, ultimately.
Yeah, I agree. Well, what is one big challenge that you feel either your community or your organization is facing right now? And how are you tackling it?
So, I mean, this is whatever dollar question, million dollar, billion dollar question, right? Like, I mean, in terms of the challenges, I think, that are so multi-layered in all of our communities today, I think one require us to step back and realize, like, we as an organization shouldn't be, you know, the savior alone. And we're actually being completely patronizing and setting ourselves up for failure to be like, oh, our organization will solve all the challenges of Boston. I mean, our mission, our vision is that community collaboration cultivates equity for all Bostonians. That requires collaboration. And it is really hard right now, I think, to generate that collaboration because everyone is really stretched, working two jobs, paying the cost of living in Boston. The challenges in our city are pretty deep and structural. It's a very expensive place to live. The cost of housing continues to skyrocket. You know, the pandemic and even the 2008 recession didn't slow down anything in regards to housing costs. You know, schools are struggling. There's a myriad of interconnected issues. So for us as an organization, I think the challenge that we face is, how do we stay true to the key program, the programs that we provide, the money and the resources, the gathering spaces and leadership development in a way that connects people and collaborates with other organizations doing that work and doesn't then burn out our talented team? I think we've spent a lot of time now in our ninth year around staff sustainability. And it's worked, right? We have a team that, as they've joined, they don't leave. We've created a sabbatical policy, after 5 years, that members, that our team members who have worked with us for 5 years full time receive a 3 month, paid sabbatical leave. We call it restorative leave, with a commitment to then return for at least a year after. These are things that we can do to value time in a way that we can't necessarily with, you know, incredible compensation and just the challenges of a nonprofit. So the strain that I think we face as an organization is we're structured in a way that our staff is program facing. And that's what, you know, you want to see in funders like, but we don't have a director of development. We don't have a director of operations or finance. That be me, as it is for so many organizations and probably people listening to this. And I don't think it's that, you know, I think it would be a, you know, like we don't have the needs for a full-time director of operations, right? But we do need to build up more of our back end so that our front end can better deliver on the programs. Because ultimately it means that our program staff does get pulled into operational things.
Right. Or, you know,
we had a site visit and the program staff is a part of it. You know, it's like the more that we can build up the operational work, the stronger our programmatic team can deliver.
Yeah, of course. I always say I spend a lot of time working in the organization and not on the organization. So I think somewhat similar, how can I become more, maybe less operational?
Yeah. It's a catch. It's a challenge that won't ever go away, but I think we could get better balanced at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's flip the narrative. It's about that time for some good news for nonprofits. We always try to end our session with this little segment. What good news would you like to share with our listeners today?
I love the question, right? We start our network nights when we gather 50, 60, 70 people in a room, as we will tomorrow night and on a weekly basis. And we also do it on Zoom, but in person, it's really powerful. Everybody goes around the room and has 30 seconds to introduce themselves and to share one thing that's new and good in their life. And we do that because we're all walking in the door with a lot of new and bad things in our life or new and exhausting things. But we're going to share and connect in this space. And when we go around the room, it creates this kinetic energy. You know, some people say, I don't have anything good to share. You know, I got out of bed this morning. Like, all right, way to go. But gradually someone shares, you know, I just found out I'm cancer free. You know, my child just, you know, graduated college. You know, I just put down a down payment on a home. And the energy and the claps and things, that is really important. And so closing with this question, I think in every sector, there are the grinds about it, and there are kind of all of the frustrations of the nonprofit sector. From my vantage point, those challenges and frustrations outweigh any of the positives or benefits of any other sector. That, you know, the work that we're doing is so important. And for better or for worse, can't be done in other sectors because you're beholden to other stakeholders, whether that's government entities or for-profit, you know, you have other stakeholders. And in a nonprofit, you do have the stakeholders of grantee, you know, grantors and funders, but your stakeholder are your people, your members, your clients, constituents. So the good news, I love the question. The good news is a gradual one, and I hope it's being felt, maybe not by everybody, but the last couple of years, I have felt a gradual shift. I wouldn't say it's immediate or seismic, but in the way that a lot of foundations and funders are granting their money.
Mm.
And it is going in the direction it needs to, that it is generally more unrestricted, more, not always, more multi-year, you know, more operational and less heavy reporting, multiple site visits, documentation. This could be a little bit of chicken and egg on our part of that. We also shy away and we don't pursue those that are going to require us to document how much toilet paper we've allocated and all those silly things. But we haven't had to because I've noticed and felt places that I used to apply to, like their questions have become shorter and less.
Yeah.
And the restrictions have been on the decline. It's not to say it won't come back, it won't change, but I think there's a better understanding of it. We've got to invest and trust in nonprofits to do.
Yeah.
Yes, there has to be accountability and measures, but let's have the nonprofit tell us what it is they're measuring, what they're accountable to, and follow their lead. And not just be in a place of like, well, we have our three priority areas, and then every 3 years we change our three priority areas, and you know, so you're out of luck after 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've felt that. I think it's made our job easier. It does require a continued push. And that's why I say it now, an advocacy on our part that it is working and that funders should continue to understand that, like, you can't fund a program without funding the staff to run the program. It just is like so hypocritical and bizarre to have requirements like that. Let that go.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to spend the money. You know, it's just like, I think the research around, you know, we say, oh, we shouldn't give people who need money, money, right? They're going to spend it on bad things. Like, no, all the research shows when people get, whether it's universal basic income or some type of cash transfer, they're spending it on the things that they need for their families. I think you could probably say the same thing for nonprofits as a whole. Yeah. Will they be a corrupt nonprofit? Yeah, they will also get shut down. Goes around, comes around. Nonprofits will spend the money in the way that is best needed by their members. And I see that changing.
Yeah.
I'm saying it so it too will be true.
Yeah. I think I see the same thing. And I think that is a result of kind of this rising tide of nonprofit education, which has equipped nonprofits to advocate for themselves, but also for local organizations who support nonprofits to also teach these foundations and grant-making institutions.
Yes.
To strengthen those relationships. And I think that, again, this is like an outcome of all three of those things happening.
Yeah. Let's keep making it happen. I agree.
Yeah, of course. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on, Eric.
Likewise. Really appreciate the questions and conversation.
Yeah, of course. If someone wants to learn more about Union Capital Boston, how can they find you guys?
Hopefully, you can come right to our website easily. We've shortened it down as we're growing. So it's just unioncapital.org. And I say capital with an A, not like a capital building with an O. So unioncapital.org. Once you get there, we have a contact form. We have our newsletter. We've got our social media. So just go to that website and you'll get our Facebook, Instagram, other things if you want to poke around. We've got a lot of good stuff, as well as research and our impact reports that tell in more detail about what we've been able to do.
Yes, incredible. We all look forward to watching you guys continue to do great things.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Talk to you guys all next week on the next episode of the Nonprofit Hub Radio Podcast. Thanks for joining us for this Nonprofit Hub Radio podcast episode. For more resources on fundraising, marketing, and all things nonprofit, be sure to check out the number one nonprofit toolbox at nonprofithub.org. We hope you'll join us next week for another episode of the Nonprofit Hub Radio podcast.